That music is somewhat emblematic of the theme of our show today. This is our Monday Scramble. But everything we're talking about today in some way or another hinges on memory. And you can make the argument that much of our public discourse hinges on memory anyway. But today we'll be talking about the appeal of the murder conviction of Adnan Syed, who is, of course, featured on the podcast Serial. This is in connection with the murder of Haemin Lee. And then as we go from there, as we transition from there, we're going to talk to Maria Konnikova, one of our favorite writers, who has a very, very a much read and circulated piece in The New Yorker right now about the fallibility and fungibility of memory, and also about the pure and weird and almost quantum mechanics of memory. And then towards the end, we'll be talking to Russell Berman from The Atlantic about the revival of the Harper Lee manuscript, which also hinges on what is remembered and the way things are remembered and the way things are forgotten, including the claim by Harper Lee herself that she had forgotten the existence of this manuscript. But we decided to go quickly first here because our first guest has a limited amount of time. Rabia Chaudhry joins us, lawyer and national security fellow at the New America Foundation. She's the person who brought the case of Adnan Syed to the attention of radio producer Sarah Koenig, who produced the first season of the podcast Serial, which is about the case. So first of all, Rabia Chaudhry, welcome to our show. Thank you for your time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, in your own words, tell us what this latest legal development is in this case. It's a rather unusual one, given the timeline of the jurisprudence in this case, right?
It is. It's unusual, not just because of the timeline, but just in generally, it's very difficult to get a chance for a new appeal, and that's really what it was. We lost the post-conviction appeal about a year ago. That's when it was denied. And almost immediately, his attorney had filed for the opportunity to just file a new post-conviction. You have to get permission from the court, and this was them granting that permission. So it doesn't happen very often, and it also happened very, very quickly, which is also unusual.
So what happens from here? What are the steps that follow?
What happens next is that we get another shot at the same claims that were raised in the earlier post-conviction. So we get to go back in front of judges and argue that his attorney was ineffective and raise the same issues about Asian Klein and plea deal.
So
if we win on that level, he could get a new trial.
Yeah. So just to sort of help people understand this then. So I mean the spear point of this appeal is an ineffective counsel claim, right? That his attorney at the time of the trials was ineffective.
Yeah, that's the basis of the post-conviction, yep.
And then the arguments within that Uber argument are that there was a key witness who was simply never pursued or investigated, despite the fact that she volunteered herself. That's Asia McClain. And then the whole question of the plea deal. So really quickly, because I know your time is limited, sketch out the Asia McClain part of this. This is somebody who claims she can place the defendant in a place that he shouldn't be, according to the prosecution's timeline.
Right. So very basically, the prosecution argued that the victim, Haemin, was killed right after school around 2:30, maybe up to 3. After Adnan was arrested, like literally in the 2 days following his arrest, Asian Klein is a student at the school who wrote him letters saying, "I remember the day she disappeared. I was with you at the library. All this stuff happened." Now, Adnan was not aware of the state's timeline at the time. He didn't know exactly when Haemin had been killed or what the state's case was because he had just been arrested. He gave those letters to his attorney. And the attorney came back to him and said, "Well, Asia's, story did not check out. Maybe she had her dates wrong or something." She just kind of blew it off. He brought it up a number of times, but there was just basically a response that no, it's not, her statements aren't useful to us. Now, after he was convicted, that's when I first learned about her. I went to speak to her, and she's like, "Nobody ever contacted me." She's like, she tried to talk to his attorney. She's like, I had written to him a couple of times. He's like, and I thought, well, maybe I'm not useful. So she basically, has said for 15 years, and I got an affidavit from her then. She's like, his attorney never even attempted to reach her. Forget investigate the alibi witness, but never attempted to reach her. And she still maintains that she was with him right after school at the exact time that the prosecution is saying that the victim was murdered.
Now, one of the other points that will be made as part of this appeal is this whole question of a plea deal. Quickly sketch that out for us.
Well, the plea deal in relation to the ineffective assistance is that, as the date of the trial was getting closer, Adnan was becoming aware, I mean, he was incarcerated, first of all, but he was becoming aware that he really wasn't able to place himself throughout the day. You know, he had to be able to provide himself alibis. And nothing, you know, Asia apparently had not checked out, according to his lawyer. He had given his attorney his email login stuff to say, can you just check my emails to see when I logged in and out that day? And he was unable to establish, like, this, you know, any kind of, like, alibi. So he talked to his attorney and said, can you tell me if the state is offering a plea in this case? Because he had no priors. And he also was advised by many other inmates to just at least check it out. So Gutierrez came back to him, and this happened twice, and said that they're not offering a plea. So this is two occasions, and the state admits, the state actually concedes that Gutierrez never even approached them. And that is her duty. If the client's asking, she has to at least approach the state. So that's two occasions when Adnan specifically requested her to do something. Not only did she not do it, but then she lied about it.
This is a hard thing to do, hard to look into the mind of the Court of Special Appeals in the state of Maryland. But it does seem almost impossible that the podcast serial didn't have some influence on this. Is there anything anybody can know or say about this?
I mean, I don't, like you said, it would be pure speculation, but I do think it might, you know, there might be a couple of factors at play here. One, in terms of how rapidly it's happened. One, that, you know, they are getting slammed with, like, media requests and other people trying to figure out what's happening in the case. So maybe they're thinking, if we dispense with it quicker, you know, it's off their plate. The second thing I think also is that the supplement that was filed recently to Adnan's petition includes the allegation that the lead prosecutor in the last post-conviction actually lied under oath. And I think, you know, when something like that happens, that's like a major, I mean, it literally undermines the integrity of the entire proceeding. And maybe that's something that moved them to realize that this is, like, kind of serious and they have to get to it quicker. But that's just speculation. I don't know. But I am very surprised. I think we're all very surprised.
Last question, because I know you have to go. You're at a conference right now. One of the things that became clear in Serial is just the difficulty of piecing together memories from 1999. It's a long time ago. So as you imagine moving forward, I guess you'll get the hearing on this in June. And then, you know, if you're successful, get a new trial. But the new trial, it would seem to me, faces the same kinds of hurdles that Sarah Koenig faced, which is, you know, how can you reconstruct reliable memories from such a distance?
Right. Well, I mean, you know, first of all, we have to remember in any given trial when the defendant is presumed innocent, right? I mean, it might not be a reality, but he's presumed innocent. The state is the one that has to prove the case that, you know, this is how it was done, this is when it was done, that we have evidence to that extent. The two pieces of evidence they used was Jay Wiles, you know, an eyewitness basically, but he's changed his story so many times. Not only that, but he actually, after the podcast ended, gave an interview in which he admits that he committed perjury on the stand. He said, it didn't happen like that at all. I lied in court. And, you know, he gave a whole other rendition of his story. So I think basically he's kind of useless to the state if they have to go back. The second piece of evidence they used to corroborate Jay's statements, which don't help anymore, is the cell phone tower evidence, which also was the first case in Maryland to use such evidence. And in the interim has been shown to be extremely flaky and unreliable and did not even show what the prosecution was purporting it to show. So I don't think the state has anything to go back on. If we were to be remanded for a new trial, I really do think the state would offer him a plea for time served.
Well, that's great. That, from your point of view anyway, that's great. I have to be an impartial journalist, even though I was a fan of the show. Rabia Chaudhry, I know your time is limited. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I had a great time.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
So we're going to transition over to Maria Konnikova as we do this. And Maria Konnikova's current piece is called You Have No Idea What Happened, which could apply to Brian Williams or to Adnan Syed and the murder of Haman Lee or to a bunch of other things. But maybe even to set Maria up, let's hear one of the opening parts of the podcast Serial in which Sarah Koenig asked people to try to remember something at a distance.
Now imagine you have to account for a day that happened 6 weeks back. Because that's a situation in the story I'm working on, in which a bunch of teenagers had to recall a day 6 weeks earlier. And it was 1999, so they had to do it without the benefit of texts or Facebook or Instagram. Just for a lark, I asked some teenagers to try it.
Do you remember what you did on that Friday?
Not at all. I can't remember anything.
Wait, nothing?
No, I can't remember anything that far back. I'm pretty sure I was in school. I think. No?
That's Tyler. He's 18. I asked my nephew, Sam. He's 18, too.
Not a clue. In school, probably. I would be in school. Actually, I think I worked that day. No, yeah, I worked that day, and I went to school. That was about it.
Actually, on second thought?
I don't think I went to school that day.
You don't think you went?
Yeah, no, I didn't. I definitely didn't.
Here's Sam's friend, Elliot. He seemed to have better recall.
Actually, I may have gone to the movies that night later.
Do you remember what
you
saw?
Now that I'm thinking. I'm sorry. Yeah, I think I saw 22 Jump Street.
Okay. And did you go with friends?
Yeah. I went with Sam and Kid Sean, Carter, a bunch of people.
Wait, Sam, my nephew Sam?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay. So Sam says he was at work.
Oh, then it wasn't that night then.
All right. All of this is of great interest to Maria Konnikova. She's a contributor to TheNewYorker.com, where she writes a weekly blog focusing on psychology and science. One of her previous books was about Sherlock Holmes, so she knows a lot about trying to solve mysteries and crimes. But Maria Konnikova, even hearing that and hearing the conversation that I was having with Rabia Chaudhry, one of the things that we know is that the more science, the more research that is directed at memory, the more we begin to see it much less as some kind of linear monorail stretching back into the past, and the more we see it as this almost, you know, highly disorganized library system full of clerks, some of whom are half drunk as they run around stuffing things in filing cabinets, pulling them out and refocusing what has been remembered in the past. I mean, the idea that memory is intact and reliable seems to be kind of on the firing line these days.
That's absolutely right, Colin. The more we learn, the more we realize that you really can't trust memory for almost anything. Now, I wasn't at all surprised to hear those recollections from Serial, because on any given day, unless something really significant happens around which your memory can coalesce, your mind isn't going to store that because it's really not important. Why does it matter to you to recall the details of every single day in the past? So unless there's a reason to do that, and more often than not, there isn't, it just kind of blurs together into your routine, what you do every single day. And so you can't really say separate Monday from Tuesday from Wednesday.
So, but one of the things that you looked at the research that crops up around a very familiar statement. People will say, I'll always remember where I was when I heard the JFK had been shot, if you're a member of my generation, mm-hmm. or when the Challenger blew up, or when 9/11 happened, or you pick something like that. So that's the alternative, something that's absolutely seared in your memory. And so the research does indicate that that's the case, although it doesn't really indicate that I would therefore know what color sweatshirt I was wearing on that day or what route I took to work or what I had for lunch, right?
That's absolutely right. So what you're describing is known as flashbulb memory, and the concept has been around since the 19th century. William James called it a scar on your memory. And it's that sense that, you know, something happened and you know exactly where you were, what you were doing, what was happening. But we now know that flashbulb memories, despite our confidence, aren't all that accurate. So we usually remember two things about what happened. We do remember where we were, so location seems to be pretty central, and we also remember the order in which something happened. So in one of the famous studies of flashbulb memories where people were asked about the Challenger explosion, he could normally say, oh, you know, first I heard about it, then I did this, or maybe first the Challenger exploded, then the snoozecast came up. You're not going to get those major details wrong, but everything else, who you were with, how exactly you found out, you know, all of those details that you think are exactly accurate may even be worse than they are for a normal, everyday, non-flashbulb memory, because you have such tunnel vision on that main event that you forget everything around it and you start distorting it. And every time you revisit the memory, you distort it even further.
The whole conversation reminds me of the opening paragraphs of Wally Lamb's novel She's Come Undone, in which the narrator remembers the delivery of the family's first TV set in 1956. She remembers the delivery men, their uniforms, the box, the way they carried it crab-like sideways up the steps. And then she, or Wally, writes, "Here's the undependable part. In my visual memory stubbornly insists that these men are President Eisenhower and Vice President Nixon." So and that's another part of it too. The clarity and certainty which we attach to memory isn't a particularly good guide to the actual reliability of that memory.
That's absolutely true when it comes to emotional events. When it comes to everyday events, like if I for some reason remember that yesterday, you know, well, yesterday is a bad example, but say 2 weeks ago, you asked me what I was doing Wednesday, and I can say, actually, I know exactly what I was doing. I was with a friend of mine. We had lunch, and the reason I remember is because I spilled salad dressing over my favorite blue shirt. There you go. That I'm probably accurate because it's not a particularly emotional event. I just happen to remember it for some other reason. So in moments like that, confidence and accuracy actually go together. So then when they don't go together, in these flashbulb memories, we trust our confidence when we really, really shouldn't.
We're talking to Maria Konnikova. We're going to take a quick break right now. When we come back, we're going to talk about the almost quantum nature with which, in some research, people kind of sharpen their memories about things once they've got an emotional reason to do it. I don't know if I explained that very well, but I know that Maria will. I believe that is the Science of Skinny manuscript that's set 20 years after the original Science of Skinny, but I'm not 100% sure about that. I am 100% sure that Maria Konnikova is with us right now. She writes about psychology and science for The New Yorker. She's working on a new book. Are we Konnikovians permitted to know what the next book is about?
Sure. It's called The Confidence Game, and it's about con artists.
Ooh, we can't wait. What's that Joe Mantegna movie that's so great about con men?
The House of Games.
The House of Games.
Yeah.
Where he says
David Mamet loves con artists.
Right, exactly. And he says, "Remember, I always offer you something first."
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, but we're not talking about that right now. We're talking about memory. So this morning, I was asked by the other person in my house who was Annie Lennox's original partner in the Eurythmics. For some reason or other, I knew it was Dave Stewart. I haven't even checked that, but I'm pretty sure I'm right. So in the research that you looked at, let's sort of imagine a related scenario. Let's imagine that that you were studying me and you wanted me to try to remember, first of all, a whole bunch of songs by the Eurythmics and maybe some other songs from that era. And then you wanted me to remember the names of the two principals in the Eurythmics, Annie Lennox and I'm pretty sure Dave Stewart. But at that point, you administered a shock to me. One of the things that was, I'm so upset that you would do such a thing to me, but anyway, one of the things that you found, correct me if I'm wrong about this, is that in subsequent efforts to get me to retrieve that information, not only would I be able to retrieve the Dave Stewart information when you shocked me, but I would also, even if that other information about the early career of the Eurythmics related information, if that had been imparted to me considerably before the Dave Stewart information in time, I would still have some better retrieval of it, right?
That's absolutely right. This is one of the most interesting new findings in memory. It actually just came out this month from the lab of Liz Phelps and Lila Devaci at New York University, and this is the first time ever that we show that emotional memories can actually retroactively enhance other memories. So they did the exact thing that you accuse me of wanting to do, which is giving you an electric shock when people saw certain images. And what they found was that when they got a surprise memory test later on, not only was the memory for those images enhanced, but all related images that had been shown beforehand. So their brain somehow realized, wait, this type of stuff is important. Let me go back in history and selectively enhance everything that's related. And if you think about it, that's actually a really, really adaptive thing for memory to do. So one of the examples that we spoke about with the researchers is imagine that you got that you were bitten by a dog in a new neighborhood, and then suddenly you remember all of your encounters with dogs in that neighborhood. And that actually makes a lot of sense because now you want to know, well, should I avoid all those dogs rather than forgetting all the dogs that existed?
And when you say adaptive, I mean, for example, I mean, if at a time when it really you know, when the rubber was really hitting the road. Imagine, you know, that I'm living in the grasslands of Africa in the early hominid state, and one of my, you know, confreres eats some kind of berry and dies from it. Well, not only am I going to remember him and the berry and stuff like that, but it's really good if I have these filing assistants in my brain who are going, wow, we should really sharpen up everything we remember about berries people have eaten, which ones they've lived through, all that kind of stuff. And so you're saying that the brain, I mean, it seems kind of weird, too, that the brain can, that it almost has like a little focus mechanism where it can focus on something that it didn't necessarily record with high precision to begin with.
That's absolutely right. And I think what was really interesting about this study is that it showed that the effect didn't happen right away. So if you gave them a surprise memory test immediately after the shocks, there was no retroactive enhancement. It needed at least 6 hours. So they tested people 6 hours later and 24 hours later as well. And they found that then that memory enhancement happened. So it's almost like it needs time to consolidate. So you need to kind of go back and check everything out, and then your brain makes that important decision. Okay, yes, you know, I think we should remember all similar berries so that we don't die in the future.
And first of all, I was emailing to you earlier, and I was saying, you know, in some respects, this research suggests, as has been suggested on other occasions, that one of the earliest and most acute brain researchers was Proust, because he's kind of talking about these things, right? He's talking about the marrying of different kinds of stimuli to various kinds of experiences, and then their ability to facilitate very vivid retrieval.
That's absolutely right. And one of the things we know about memory is that Proust, you know, with that famous Madeleine on the opening pages, is really dead on, because if we have a very strong emotion associated especially to a smell, there's new work that's being done all the time on just how powerful smell memories are, that we are able to retrieve them. But I'm going to challenge Proust on one thing. You know, he's writing fiction. If he were writing nonfiction, we don't actually know how accurate those events are, because we can, despite the fact that he's confident and that the smell evokes the memories, we might see the same thing, you know, that we see with the Challenger explosion or with 9/11, that you seem to remember everything, but that the emotion might have clouded over. And in fiction, that's totally fine. But when we're doing things like in Serial, relying on these memories for actual information to convict a person during a trial, it becomes very problematic.
Somebody just tweeted that Maria Konnikova challenged Proust. I'm sure somebody did that. I mean, I'm just assuming that's just the way the world works these days. So last area I want to get into before we run out of time. So one of the other things we know about memory now from the kinds of research that you cover is, you know, we've thought of memory for a long time as this kind of filing cabinet, and you go into the filing cabinet and you take out the memory and you look at the memory. And maybe as you get older, you know, you don't remember things so well for whatever reasons. But some of the more recent research indicates that really what you remember when you remember something is in fact kind of the last snapshot you took of it when you remembered it the last time, rather than remembering the primal text, the experience that the memory is based on. We remember memories, and which are remembering memories, which are remembering memories.
That's absolutely right. The more we know about memory, the more we realize that it's not just this process of you encode a memory, then you consolidate that memory, you store that memory, and you retrieve that memory. That's what we used to think happened. But now we realize that that happens over and over again every single time you retrieve. So after you retrieve, you don't just put it back, then you re-encode, reconsolidate, restore, and so on and on and on. And what happens is that instead of, you know, if you imagine it like a filing cabinet, as you're saying, the contents shift. You know, some things fall out of one file, you suddenly get something from another file in there, and you remain equally certain that you're accurate about your memory, when really it's shifting, it's changing. Crucial details might be different. It's a really interesting phenomenon because it's very counterintuitive. You would think that something that you recall often, you'd remember it better, but it seems to be that the things that we retrieve most frequently might be the things that are the least kind of the least like reality than the memories that we only go back to, say, once in our lives.
I would just make a final observation here, which is that, you know, obviously the nation is somewhat convulsed right now by this Brian Williams story. And it's possible that he photographed this memory of this incident that happened to him years ago in Iraq. And that maybe one of the reasons for the error here is just simply that process. Although I think we could both agree, not as scientists, Maria, but just as people, that the intention is important too. Like if every time I take the photograph out, I re-photograph it in the most flattering possible light and add a rocket whizzing by my head or something like that. I mean, there is some human agency here in the way that we twist and distort memory.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's why the fisherman's fish keeps getting bigger and bigger in every retelling.
Right. Or as one athlete said, the older I get, the better I used to be.
That's exactly right.
Maria Konnikova, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Colin.
All right. Maria Konnikova, she blogs about science and psychology at The New Yorker. She's got an exciting new book about con men and con games and con women and con people. Then that's coming out in the near future. Now, coming up, we're going to take a little break for fundraising, a short break. Then when we come back, we're going to talk about this new Harper Lee novel. We're going to give you maybe some details about it that you didn't know. But we also understand that To Kill a Mockingbird is, boy, talk about an text. Talk about sort of a book that everybody read and 97% of people loved. We know that this is very meaningful to you, too. So give us a call, 860-275-7266, when we get that conversation going. 860-275-7266. Tell us what the new Harper Lee novel could mean or not mean to you.
Coming up, a conversation about Harper Lee. In the final installments of the Mockingbird and Mockingjay books, Scout and Katniss team up to fight evil. Today's show was produced by Tucker Ives and me, Kyone Wolfe. Greg Hill tweets for us at WNPR Colin. The part of Bill Curry was played by Jeremy Irons. For show pages, articles, and videos of the Faith Middleton show staff remembering their Zumba class with Truman Capote, visit our website, WNPR.org. On tomorrow's show, our political behavior is less rational than we want to believe it is. And now, back to Colin.
Yeah, tomorrow is our show about what we call visceral voting, that notion that you think that you're making all these astute and conscious political choices, when in fact a lot of research indicates that your decisions are governed by emotion and by things even more limbic and reptilian than emotion, really close, very quick kinds of judgments that you might make in the first 30 seconds of seeing a picture of somebody, something like that. So anyway. That sounds like a spoiler. I don't want to tell you too much. We do want to talk to you about Harper Lee. We've got joining us to do that Russell Berman. Russell Berman, associate editor at The Atlantic, where he normally covers politics, but last week was on the Harper Lee beat along with the rest of American journalism. First of all, welcome to the show. And I think, are you from this area originally? Do I have that right?
Yes, I'm actually, I grew up in West Hartford, went to Hall High School, so... It's good to be on in Connecticut.
Yeah. No, we're eventually just going to assemble an entire show of you and Annie Lowry, and there are all these people in journalism now who basically are from West Hartford. You did get put on the Harper Lee beat last week, and one of the things that you did manage to do, and this is a really controversial decision. This book means so much to so many different people. As I was saying earlier, by the way, if anybody wants to call in and talk about this, 860-275-7266. But this book means so much to so many different people, and Harper Lee is a woman of 88 who has some pretty significant health problems. So there are myriad questions about how informed her consent has been to publish this earlier manuscript, to what degree she is a full participant in this decision. That's one of the things that you were interested in talking to the publisher of HarperCollins. What did he tell you?
Right. Well, I talked to Jonathan Burnham, who is the publisher of the forthcoming book, Ghost Set of Watchmen. And he, you know, from his perspective, from what he's heard, and remember, it's important to note that he had not talked to, nor anybody at Harper had talked to Harper Lee during this process. They had gone through her lawyer and her literary agent. But from what was reported back to him, he said Harper Lee was very much engaged in this process, and it was not, you know, a circumstance where, you know, she is not well enough to make a decision, and that they pressured her or made a decision for her. And that's, you know, and that's what he said. And he offered some, you know, some more details than what was originally put out to support that in terms of Harper Lee's reaction and the fact that she wanted, she, you know, thought that this manuscript was lost for the last 50 or so years, and so she was very surprised that it had been found. He described her as a very self-critical writer, and so she wanted some of her close confidants to read the manuscript and determine whether it was publishable in the form, and they told her that it was, quote, eminently publishable, in his words.
You know, this is a very difficult story to report on for a variety of reasons, but, for example, today we're being told that Harper Lee is mortified and troubled and hurt and humiliated that there is reporting that questions her level of participation in this, her ability to participate in a meaningful way in it, and that she's obviously, first of all, she's kind of a famously reclusive person, but on top of that, I mean, it's very painful for her to hear that that maybe she's not compos mentis or at least fully physically able to be part of this whole process. The problem is it's always coming from the same one or two places. The person telling us now this is Harper Lee's lawyer, whom you mentioned before, lawyer and friend Tanya Carter, right? Everything comes through these people.
Right. And so it becomes a matter of trust. And of course, there have been a couple of legal disputes in the last couple of years where, you know, Harper Lee's lawyer, Tanya Carter, has been, you know, some people in that community who had been close to Harper Lee have told, you know, reporters there that, you know, Tanya Carter was sort of preventing them from coming to see her, and there was all those kind of concerns. And I think this is also something that you get, you know, people make assumptions about people that are, you know, elderly, and, you know, in her case, she's had a stroke, but nobody really knows except for her and the people who see her on a day-to-day basis what the real truth is. So it just becomes a matter of trust.
I mean, it had been suggested by her sister, her highly protective older sister, who died, I think, at the age of 103, not too long ago. But the information that Harper Lee had a stroke and that the stroke had affected both her vision and her hearing. I mean, we don't really know exactly to what degree in each case, but to a certain degree, she's hearing impaired and sight impaired. I mean, and I think even the most rosy scenarios now suggest that although she reads, she has to have special magnified, extra large print thing, almost bespoke editions for her to be able to read. But it seems important somehow that this whole thing is happening. I mean, if Truman Capote or Harper Lee had written this story and it happened that this manuscript, this long-forgotten manuscript, was discovered so soon after the death of the protective and almost curatorial older sister, I mean, that does naturally raise a whole bunch of questions.
Sure. Although if you look at it another way, you know, Harper Lee is 88 years old, and if she is in poor health, obviously the publisher, you know, the people who have an interest in this would, you know, might not have to wait, you know, more than, you know, several years to be able to publish this, you know, after her death. She has been quoted by even her close friends who are skeptical of this as saying that she, you know, might have published something posthumously. And people who were, it was not widely known that this manuscript existed, but people who have come into contact with her over the years many of them seem to be aware that she had written something else.
So explain to us how this was found, that once again, it is this woman, this Tanya Carter, the lawyer and friend, who essentially found this. How was it found?
So what I was told by Jonathan Burnham is that Tanya Carter was in essentially the Harper Lee archive. He wouldn't be too specific exactly as to the location, but it was in Monroeville, near where she is now living. Tanya Carter, was looking for the original transcript for manuscript. I'm sorry, for To Kill a Mockingbird, and found as she was leafing through it that there were scenes in it, or at the end of it, that you know, were not from the book. And so the more she looked, she realized this was an entirely different novel that was affixed to the end of the manuscript of To Kill a Mockingbird. And she brought it, you know, back. She told Harper Lee about it. We've learned from other reports that Harper Lee was very surprised to hear this. And from what, you know, Jonathan Burnham said, then she had some close friends and people around her read the manuscript. They told her it was definitely publishable, and that was when the decision was made, and they entered into the agreement to publish it, and it'll come out in July.
So, I mean, one of the many things about this that's difficult to process, and you know, this entire episode that we've been doing has focused in one way or another on memory in the case that the murder case that made up the Serial podcast, which is now subject to a new appeal in Maryland, memory in the case of Brian Williams, memory in research. So we have memory in play here. I mean, one of the things that you kind of trip over when you read about this is the notion that Harper Lee had forgotten some aspect of this. She'd forgotten that this manuscript still existed somehow. She was surprised to find that Tanya Carter could find it. And yeah, she's 88 years old. She's had a stroke. There's a lot of explanations for this. Although, you know, this really is, this would, I mean, she made one trip to the plate and hit a 700-foot home run in Yankee Stadium. That's To Kill a Mockingbird, one of maybe the most popular American novel of all time. It just seems to me if you'd made one other trip to the plate, you'd remember it. I mean, I'm struggling with that a little bit. I don't know what you can do to help me there.
Well, from what I understand, it wasn't she very much remembered writing it, but she assumed that it had been lost because essentially, remember that this was essentially the first draft of To Kill a Mockingbird. She submitted this to her editor back when she was, nobody. She was a young writer who had no accomplishments, and her editor read it. It had, Scout was an adult in it, and there was only flashbacks to her childhood in Alabama, which was, of course, became the subject of To Kill a Mockingbird. And her editor said, Scout's childhood is what you want to focus on. Go back and rewrite this, and that's what became To Kill a Mockingbird. And so when we think about, well, you know, her decision to only publish and only write one book over the course of her life and wanting To Kill a Mockingbird to be her contribution to literature, it is interesting that, you know, why after all these years would she decide to publish the first draft of it, which was not thoroughly, you know, edited by professionals, and, you know, candidly might just not be as good, and it might change the what her legacy is, a little bit at least, in literature.
Russell Berman, one thing you did ask the publisher of this book is, what's it about? Obviously, we don't want too many spoilers, nor were you offered many, but you do have kind of a sense anyway what Ghost at a Watchman is about.
Right. So the To Kill a Mockingbird, as many people will recall, took place in the Great Depression in the 1930s when Scout Finch was 12 years old. Ghost at a Watchman takes place about 20 years later in the 1950s as the civil rights movement is ramping up. She has been working as an adult in New York City, and she comes back to Alabama, to her hometown. Then there's what the publisher told me was, didn't give away anything, but goes back to the town where she was born and revisits old friends and family and sort of encounters old ghosts and comes up against new ideas and opinions. It's a complicated, very adult novel that sweeps in family, politics, love, the South, is what his description of it was. So obviously that's somewhat promotional in nature, but you get a little bit of a flavor for it.
Does sound a little bit like jacket copy, doesn't it? Well, when we think about why is this such an incredibly primal book, I mean, I really do believe that if you, you know, were to poll, 500,000 Americans on their favorite book of all time, I think To Kill a Mockingbird would place high, if not at number one. It's just a book that everybody reads at some point, everybody loves. One reason everybody reads it is, you know, if for a lot of us, it's one of our first encounter with, to use an adjective you just used, somewhat darker materials, right? We're sort of seeing, you know, the evil of that era. We're seeing fundamental kinds of an unfairness. We're seeing menace directed at children, which is, you know, something maybe we're shielded from a little bit growing up. And it sounds as though this new book, I mean, one wonders, you know, what kind of place it will take in school curriculums, but it sounds like this new book, I don't know whether it's darker or less dark. I know you did ask Jonathan Burnham about that.
Right, because To Kill a Mockingbird, one reason that it's so universally loved and read is that it's read in schools. Just about every school child in America reads this book at some point or another. And so I asked him when he said, following up on when he said it was a very adult novel, is this going to be suitable for children just as To Kill a Mockingbird was? And he said it's not going to be quite as accessible because it's not told from the point of view of a child. That was one reason why and so many people can relate to Scout, is she is the narrator and she's 12 years old. But when she, and so the Gossetta Watchman is from the point of view of a young, you know, adult woman. And so obviously it's going to be different there. But he did say he thinks it could be read in schools. It was not something that had, you know, too much violence or too much sex or anything like that.
Of course. He is the publisher, so he probably hopes that's true,
right,
too.
Right, again, take that with a grain of salt.
All right. Russell Berman, thanks so much for joining us. Welcome back, at least telephonically, to your old haunts of West Hartford. Russell Berman, associate editor at The Atlantic, joining us today to talk about the story of Harper Lee's second, but really in some senses, first book. Very quickly here, we have a minute or two left. You're going to hear a little tiny bit of fundraising here at the end of this. I do urge you, particularly if this show is important to you, to be generous, to maybe make that call, particularly if you've never donated before, just because obviously the fundraising that occurs during our time slot, we get a certain amount of credit for that. So it's actually meaningful that we get it. Nice people will be coming on to talk to you about that. I also want to thank everybody who helped out today. It's a snowy day. It was hard to get in here, but people did. Kyone Wolf walked over in her yak tracks, and Tucker Ives came from east of the river. And Katie Tularski, our executive producer, manned the phones. I can see her there in her signature orange hat straight out of The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou. No, I guess those are red, right? Those are red hats, I think. Oh, well, never mind. All right, we'll be back tomorrow with a show about visceral voting. Thanks for listening today. With queens and kings, cows jumping and dinosaurs. I've been cats and hats and flying cars. I'm your favorite book. I'm your favorite book. I'm your favorite book. I'm your favorite book. I'm your favorite.